and welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And today is March 22nd, 2026. And we'll be talking about it the second hour. But for those of you who think that the Iran crisis that we'll be speaking about in the first hour is what's causing California gas prices to soar, I would hope you would go to our page. You can get to the gas issue directly at gascrisis.org, and please understand that even if that whole thing was solved tomorrow, our gas prices will continue to go up until the state figures it out. But it is a major national security issue. If you don't live in California, you should still care about it. And anyway, all that information's there at gascrisis.org.
Really quick, there is an app you can get on your phone called Gas Buddy.
Yeah.
And it will tell you the cheapest gas in California or in Redding.
Nice. Or wherever you are, I guess. I forgot that you sent that to me. I didn't play with that yet.
That'd be the least expensive gas.
Yeah, not the cheapest. Sorry. Least expensive gas.
The least high priced. Oh, my gosh. So our guest this first hour is Claire Lopez. Claire is a regular online blog contributor at Newsmax, and she's on air with One America News. And she's a founder and president of Lopez Liberty, LLC, with a mission to alert Americans to national security threats, both international and from the Islamic movement, the Muslim Brotherhood, and the Marxist collaborators that we have in the country. And
I love how you put that.
Yeah, well, that's right on her deal here.
100%.
But it's kind of funny because that used to make us sound a little, you know, we're skating out on the thin ice. Yeah, not so much anymore. I think people have figured that out. She received a BA in communications and French from Notre Dame College of Ohio and a master's in international relations from Maxwell School of Syracuse University. Completed Marine Corps Officer Candidate School in Quantico, Virginia, before declining a military commission to join the CIA. So Claire has been there and done that. And Middle East is her deal. She can pronounce all the stuff, so
that's important.
We will not be saying any of the secret words. We'll let Claire do that. Claire do that for us. So we didn't talk about what we're going to discuss today. We left it up to her. And it's a target rich environment for you, Claire.
Hi, Aaron and Bill. It's so good to be with you and your audience once again.
Oh, my gosh. And for those people who have not been listening, Claire's been on with us since 2016, and I have all her shows posted on our March 22nd page for today. You've been a frequent contributor. How about that?
And happy to be.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
So...
Yeah, so the Middle East, is there anything happening there?
Yeah, well...
Yeah, well, I mean, if you're watching your TV, computer screens, cell phone screens, whatever, you might have noticed a little bit of, you know, an uptick in activity over the last few weeks.
Yes. Oh, there you go. The old uptick in activity. Well, do you... I guess we could ease into it, but why do that? Do you think that this is a good trajectory we're on?
Yeah, absolutely. It's okay. A long time overdue.
Yeah.
You probably know. I mean, we've been talking with each other for, 10 years or so. But you'll probably know that I have focused on Iran in particular in the Middle East all of that time. We know from respected sources, International Atomic Energy Agency, David Albright's what they call the good ISIS, that is the Institute for the Study of Science and International Security, as well as the Iranian opposition, National Council of Resistance of Iran, with which I've been working and supporting them for, almost 20 years, I think. But from all of those sources, you know, we'll have seen that Iran has been driving for a deliverable nuclear weapons capability. There's no question about that. And as the news became more and more alarming, within the last couple of weeks, more than that, 2-3 weeks, it was understood by President Trump, thank goodness for President Trump, and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, was realized that Iran was really at the cusp, right on the edge of the capability to put together a nuclear warhead. No, not just one, I should say, more like 10. And that has to do with what's been openly acknowledged by Rafael Grossi, the Director General of the IAEA and others in the U.S. government, that more than 400 kilograms, that's over 900 pounds, of highly enriched uranium was missing. And we don't know where it is. Maybe some intelligence agencies do, but we don't, and IAEA didn't. Missing, but if enriched from that 60% that the regime in Iran admits to, up to weapons grade, which is considered to be about 90, 92, 93% enriched, that would take, oh, a couple of weeks, and would be enough to make 10 nuclear warheads. That is what galvanized, that's what set off the urgency for Israel's Operation Roaring Lion and the U.S.'s Operation Epic Fury.
And what about their ability to deliver that payload? I understand their ballistic missile program was advancing rapidly. How close were they on that?
Well, exactly so. And we'll have seen that reporting just over the last few days about the Iranian regime sending a couple of its intermediate range ballistic missiles, that being around 4,000 kilometers range, in the direction of Diego Garcia, where the United States, of course, as we know, you know, has for a long time maintained a large base, military base there. Those ballistic missiles of Iran, fortunately, one just misfired and fell short en route. The other one was shot down, so never reached the targets. But the fact that those intermediate-range ballistic missiles aimed at Diego Garcia, if they had made it all the way there, would have been 4,000 kilometers. That is at least twice as far, or nearly twice as far, as anybody ever thought Iran's ballistic missiles were capable of going.
Mm.
Now, the other part of that is other open source reporting. Again, I've mentioned the National Council of Resistance of Iran. That's the Iranian opposition group, headquartered in Paris, outside of Paris, actually. But that they had been reporting in open press briefings held at their Washington, D.C. offices over the last year, 2025, which I attended, along with many other representatives, journalists, reporters of the media. And in those press briefings, the NCRI deputy director in particular of that office, Ali Reza Jafarzadeh, presented evidence repeatedly, as I said, 3-4 different press briefings that I attended, the evidence that in ballistic missile weapon sites out in Iran's far eastern province of Semnan, there were, I don't know, 2, 3, 4 ballistic missile sites, including Shahrud, Ivanaki, Sanjarian, others too, where the Iranians were working on adapting, or the final steps of fitting, warheads, not fully developed yet, but in development, nuclear warheads, to the nose cones of their ballistic missiles. This work going on at ballistic missile weapon sites. So that, too, gets to your question, Bill, and probably also caught the attention of American and Israeli leadership as to the urgency, the imminence of the threat.
Right.
Yeah, because we're just, you know, awash in, you know, Democrat hysteria that there was no reason to do this. This just came out of the blue. There, you know, what are we thinking?
Well, what are they thinking? Obviously, they were not doing their homework at all. They have not read the same totally, completely open source reporting or attended the same press briefings that many of us did. And this is what I'm talking about is all completely open source. I'm not even talking about what intelligence agencies like Mossad or CIA or any others, you know, might have collected. No idea what that would be. No access to it. But open source reporting alone would have informed anyone who cared to pay attention.
Yeah, and then, you know, along with that, the whole idea that we should have given everybody notice that we were going to do something. It's like, you know, I'm pretty sure that that is not part of anybody's battle plan.
Yeah, that was a one of President Trump's little quips there at the Oval Office meeting this past week with Japanese Prime Minister visiting the United States.
That was awesome.
That was
so cool.
Yeah, Takayuchi. He mentioned, how about Pearl Harbor? Replying to a reporter's question. He was taking questions there in the Oval Office together with Sonny Takayuchi, the Prime Minister. And that was his quip. Well, how about
because they're like, why didn't you tell everybody? Why didn't you warn everybody? Yeah.
Not thinking straight, I guess. I don't know.
The reaction on that was actually pretty funny. You could see the uh-huh. the translation and the and. You know, you got to realize after somebody says a thing like that, it's like, oh, wow.
Do you think some of those reporters are plants that are in there in the Oval Office?
Sure. That may be. I don't know this particular one or who it was, but that's possible.
Yeah, it was just sad.
The other side of this is, you know, they're saying, oh, well, we were in negotiations, but has Iran ever honored any of the agreements that they've made in past negotiations?
No, certainly not. We could go all the way back to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, to which the Iranian regime remains a signatory. We can look at, more recently, the 2015 JCPOA, Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, which was supposed to have limited the enrichment of uranium by the Iranian regime to 3.67%, and they themselves now admit they've blasted at least up to 60%. I think probably more. So no, they don't keep signatures, to agreements they have signed. But I'll mention this, and many may not realize this, but under Islamic law. To which the current Iranian regime adheres very faithfully. Under Islamic law, it is obligatory for faithful Muslims to lie to infidels in those cases in which the objective to be achieved, here, of course, jihad, is likewise obligatory.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, duh.
Yeah,
it
really looked like it was just a big stall tactic with the negotiations they had going on. They just wouldn't come clean with anything, and I think Trump just got fed up with it. It's time to act if you're not going to come to the table.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
I mean I think President Trump and his negotiators, Steve Witkoff, Jared Kushner, the others, I think they tried as hard as they could to show that they were trying to negotiate in good faith and give every opportunity for negotiations with the Iranian regime to succeed. And then finally, President Trump just had enough, and he knew perfectly well, and so did the negotiators, you know, that Iran was, to coin a phrase here, just tapping them along. Mm-hmm. And that was it. That was the end of that effort.
Yeah, at some point you have to call it. I mean, you know, I always go back to children and dogs. You know, if it doesn't work with children and dogs, it isn't working anywhere else either. And there comes a limit with both children and dogs where you have to
draw the line and no more.
Yeah,
and especially like we mentioned just a bit ago, you know, the intelligence, open source and otherwise, coming in about where Iran was with its nuclear weapons development and delivery systems, the ballistic missiles.
Yeah. Well, I also find it amazing that the reporting is so sketchy on the number of people that they've murdered. I immediately contacted some of the folks that we've worked with for a long time in the Organization of American Iranian Communities out here, and the OIC guys are like, they killed 30,000 people. It's like, huh.
I'm not even sure that anyone, including the regime, actually knows the true number.
That's probably true.
I'm not sure that they've counted them all, and no, actually, and certainly we don't, on the outside, necessarily know the true number either, but it was horrifically
It was
high.
Huge. I mean, it wasn't just a few. Hey, Claire, let's take a quick break, but when we come back, I know this is kind of a weird question, but... just out of curiosity, since you have a lot more time studying these guys, I'm really curious to know how you ultimately win a conflict, how you run a country, how you convince everybody to be on your team. If you're just murdering everybody, like all the guys that should be on your team, like, you don't want to be on the team, great, we'll just kill all of you. I'm curious the mindset that creates that as a strategy, I guess. We'll be right back. Our guest is Clara Lopez. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Boys, you gotta draw a hard line.
When the gun smoke settles, we'll sing a victory tune, and we'll all meet back at the local saloon.
We'll raise up our glasses against evil forces, singing whiskey for my men, beer for my horses.
I had to play that one, Claire. That was the first time Dr. Peter Pry ever laughed on our show. We played that song, and he laughed, and he said, "That is my favorite song."
Oh, we miss him.
Isn't he? Ugh, I miss him too. And I thought, oh, Claire's on. We'll play Peter's. We'll flip to Peter's special music list.
Good one. A good one there.
So, I mean, is it just? It just, there's such ideologues that they don't see that is kind of a crazy thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, you nailed it with that word. Ideologues, theocratic ideologues, true, faithful, believing, practicing Shiite Muslims. The objective of such a regime is to take power, wield power, keep power. It doesn't matter if the people are with you or against you. It doesn't matter, you know, that you have to slaughter tens of thousands of your own people to maintain that power. That's irrelevant to a leadership as ideologically committed as the Shiite Twelvers, whoever's left at this point, of the Iranian regime.
Yeah. So in your estimation, do the people eventually just stop fighting them and go along, or have they hit the tip? The OIAC guys think that they've hit the tipping point and that nobody's backing up on this.
The people, you mean?
Basically the revolution, right?
Yeah. No. Absolutely. I agree with their assessment. You know, this regime has now been in power for something like 47 years. Before that, it was an autocratic monarchy, again, not a democracy, but nowhere near as savage and brutal and awful as this regime that followed it with the Ayatollah Khomeini's 1979 revolution. And the people have risen up during those 47 years time and time again. We'll note that sort of geographically, ethnic minorities are located around the periphery of central Iran, if you will. So what I mean is the Baluchis are down along and across Iran's border with Pakistan, come up to the Caspian Sea, and you've got the Turkmen, you've got the Azeris up there, over to the northwest, and again crossing the border between Iran and Iraq, and that's the Kurds, very large population of ethnic Kurds, whose people are also, of course, located in Syria. And then down around to the southwest, along the Persian Gulf, is the province called Khuzestan, and the people there are Arabs. Ahwaz Arabs, they are called, and they really resent being dominated by a Persian regime headquartered in Tehran. They are not Persian, they speak Arabic, and the others too. The ethnic minorities resent being ruled from Tehran. And I'll say that together, all of those amount to maybe almost or just about 50% of the Iranian population, which is around 90 million total. And the other 50% or so are comprised of Persians, actual Persians,
mm-hmm.
Well, what, 30, 40%? And then the remaining 20%, and these are, you know, sort of really, you know, extra hypothetical, not hypothetical, but my best estimates of the population, maybe 20% of the Iranian population is Azeri. And the currently eliminated supreme leader, the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, was Azeri. So anyway, it's a mixed population is what I'm getting at, and many of them resent being controlled from the center by a Persian Azeri elite. And so they were never going to be okay with that situation. And many of those, Baluchis, certainly, Kurds, certainly, Ahwaz Arabs, certainly, have been armed. For a very long time.
Yeah.
In an armed revolt against the central regime. Being on the periphery, I guess it's easier to smuggle in weapons and other things to places, you know, on the periphery of the country, which has happened.
Well, and the Kurds have really been subjected to a lot of abuse for a very long time.
All of them. I mean, we can go back a lot farther even than the 79 revolution. Iran is an ancient, beautiful cultural civilization that goes back more than 2,500 years. And they were independent, they were advanced, they were a beautiful civilization until about the 640s, current era, when the armies of Islam invaded, Muslim armies of Islam invaded, and I guess, you know, the Persian Empire had been exhausted in decades of fighting against the Byzantine Empire, at that time powerful too. Anyway, they went down. The Persian Empire went down to the invading Islamic armies in the 640s by 650 or so. And they were taken over. They were never Islamic before that. Islam was imposed upon them from these invaders. They were Zoroastrian. Zoroastrianism is probably about as old, dating back as far as Judaism, the Jewish faith. And likewise, it is one true God, belief in a one true God, creator of the earth. They call him the Ahura Mazda. And from Zoroastrianism come many of the ideas that infuse both Judaism and Christianity. For instance, the difference between the juxtaposition of good versus evil, light versus dark. And right now, this past week, as a matter of fact, people in Iran who remember and still celebrate their culture have celebrated something called Chahar Shanbeh. And that is the festival of the lights, the festival of fire, really. And you'll have noticed maybe in the news that especially the young folks, they'll build little fires, not great big ones, little fires in like the parking lots of their apartment buildings or open spaces. And they, the guys do this, the young guys go running and they jump over the fire. And that is symbolic of this time of year when spring is beginning, winter is receding, and it is the symbol of going from the dark of winter to the light of spring. And indeed, Saturday, the 21st of March, this year, Saturday the 21st, was celebrated as Nowruz. Nowruz is Farsi, two words. No means new. Ruz means day. New day, or actually, new year. They celebrate the beginning of the new year with the spring equinox, the 21st of March, which makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
And again, this is keeping their cultural heritage alive. And they will set in their homes a table full of what they call the Haft Sin. Haft means seven. Sin means the letter S, or the sound of S, S. So seven S's. And these are items that they put on the table, all of them in Farsi beginning with the letter S. And they include things like new green shoots, a little planter of green shoots, pomegranate, chicken eggs, maybe a candle to symbolize the light, although that one doesn't begin with S, but that'll be on the table. These kinds of things keep the traditions alive. That's who the Iranian people are. And
are they allowed to do that with the people that are in charge?
Well, they're not approved of, certainly,
okay.
And there are, you know, all kinds of pronouncements from the regime about how awful it would be to celebrate Chahar Shanbeh or Nowruz. Yeah, but they do it anyway. This is how, through the centuries, they've kept alive, their own culture and civilization, which is really beautiful and shares really a lot of similarity, you know, with our own Judeo-Christian, beliefs and principles.
Yeah, it's interesting because the guys I met quite some time ago at a Marco Rubio thing down in Sacramento, and we started chatting, and they, at a coworker, and she said, "Oh, you know, Fred and Ross, you know, they're Iranians for, you know, they've been here for a long time," and they both looked at me, they're like, "Yeah, we're not, we're Persian."
Yeah, they won't make that distinction.
Yeah,
you know, obviously
they're like, "No, we're Persian."
Yeah, everybody in Iran is not Persian. Many ethnic minorities, but one of the ideas that I think certainly is talked about and maybe can be established after the fall of this regime, which is going down. But one of the ideas would be to have a kind of a federated system of government take this regime's place, with guaranteed autonomy for these ethnic minorities, so that in their own schools, for example, they can teach the children in their own language. And they would be autonomous, just like American states have our own legislatures, but send legislators to the central, U.S. Congress in Washington, D.C.
Sure.
And it could be something like that. Perhaps.
Well, they've, when I was speaking with them, two things really struck me. He said the Kurds have been subjugated for such a long time and subjected to so much really just, you know, bad things.
Abuse and oppression.
Yeah, oppression. That's kind of the word I couldn't find. Mm-hmm. And he said because of that, most of them are not literate in their own language because they're not allowed to speak it. And he said they're really angry about that. And they want their culture back. So we were chatting, and I said, well, since I am not an expert on the Middle East, I was like, well, are you going to go back to a previous time? I mean, can you put your government back to where where it worked well? And he said, you know, we have never been a democratic society. We don't. Yeah, he said, we don't know anything about it.
But it can be established because people know what it's like. Certainly,
right.
A place like the United States, although not quite the same geographically with our ethnic groups, but certainly, we have many ethnic representations among our citizens, among our people. And we have states, again, as we were saying, 50 different states, each with its own governor elected by the people of that state, each with its own legislature, but then again, all owing allegiance to Washington, D.C., the central government of the United States, and the United States Constitution that brings us all together. And that brings me to a point. After this regime falls, you know, whatever groups there are that can join together are going to have a transitional period. The NCRI, Mariam Rajavi, talks about a six-month period. I think that's reasonable. To write a new constitution and to hold elections for a new, freely and fairly elected,
right.
New majlis or parliament for Iran. That is something that is being talked about right now by many in the opposition to this regime.
How do they... So the guys that are I'm unclear. You have a whole lot of people who are loyal to this old regime that appears to be now either dead or MIA. So who are they loyal to? Like, who are they fighting? Who do they think they're fighting for? Or have they just been doing it so long they're on autopilot?
Well, you know, if you're talking about national Iranian security forces like the IRGC, Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, its constituent units like the Quds Force, like the Basij. Basij are those guys all dressed in black that did a lot of the killing on the streets back in January of the protesters. You'll see them often in black, dressed as if so black, on black motorcycles and so forth. They did a lot of the slaughter. They did a lot of the killing. They're part of subordinate to the IRGC, so IRGC, and also the national police. But just as you say, Aaron, because this regime has essentially been decapitated, I mean, not just decapitated, but down to the second, third, and fourth levels, the newly appointed leadership figures last, life expectancy about 24 hours. And so what has happened is that in the 31 provinces of Iran, each of the local, provincial units of these different security forces, they have nobody giving them orders anymore. They have no one to turn to ask for direction. So they're kind of on, dead man's hand or autopilot.
They are kind of on an autopilot.
On going on old orders, perhaps. I'll kill them all. But at the same time, realizing the way things are going, as I understand it, there's a fair number of defections and people just laying, laying down their arms, going over to the people.
Yeah, like so, I'd be looking for some casual street clothes to blend in, and
maybe put my mean guy
uniform in my neighbor's house.
Turn over your weapons to the people before you go change clothing.
Yeah, hope everybody doesn't know. I mean, I wonder how a deal like that works. I have to take a really quick break. When we come back, I'm not sure, has this happened somewhere before in modern time where really you had this, I don't know, like army, I guess, that was kind of self running itself, and what that how that plays itself out. How do you think it'll play itself out, maybe? Our guest is Claire Lopez. She's going to come back and tell us all about that in just 2 minutes. You're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
That was just a dream. That was just a dream. That's me in the corner. Spot life, losing my religion, trying to keep up with you, and I don't know if I can do it.
Yes. Well, sorry about that previous promotion. We do not promote that, actually, and have done many shows on that particular topic. So if you would like to learn more, go to the pot tab at wethepeopleradio.us. That said, back to Claire.
I had a question, Claire.
No, wait. She has to tell me about how they're going to win.
Oh.
You know, how we get rid of the autonomous army.
Okay, well, real quick, and then Bill.
Yeah.
The example that comes to mind for some of us might be the collapse in 1991 of the Soviet Union, right? And the socialist republics that formerly had been part of that, coerced to be part of that, broke away, as did the Warsaw Pact countries that had been trapped behind the Iron Curtain, broke away from domination by Moscow. You know, that's not what we're hoping will happen with Iran. I think the best outcome and what many hope for is that the country can remain united with its ethnic minorities, but again, with protections and autonomy for those minorities. The other thing about the Soviet Union, when it collapsed, the government collapsed, the geographic entity broke apart, all those republics went their own ways, but the intelligence service remained, the KGB remained in power, and it split up into its constituent parts, whereas the FSB formerly was the second chief directorate and now is the internal domestic security service of Russia, and then the SVR used to be the first chief directorate, and it is now just only the international intelligence service of Russia. So the worst possible outcome for Iran would be if the IRGC remained in control. That is not what we hope to see. So not really, a parallel situation, but something people refer to. But those are the differences, and I think we need to keep those in mind.
Yeah,
Bill, you wanted to ask something?
It's perilous.
Oh, yeah. I was just curious. What is your take on, I can't think of his name, the Shah's son, who's...
Where's the prophecy is his name.
Oh, yeah, didn't know that, Bill?
Prophecy.
Yeah, what do you think of him?
Well, he left Iran with his family in late 1978. He was just a teenager at the time. Grew up and spent the entire rest of his life in the United States. Made a very successful career as a businessman. But now is offering himself as a leader of the post-regime Iran. The thing is that, and he's a very nice man, by the way. I've been in the audience when I heard him speak. He's a good man. I think he has absolutely the, the best for Iran and the Iranian people in his heart, in his mind. But the thing is that he has not been in Iran for 47 years. He has no on-the-ground network or connections with the people of Iran, to include, many of these ethnic opposition groups, but also the Mujahideen Khalq. M-E-K, for short, stands for the People's Fighters, or Fighters for the People. That's what M-E-K stands for in Farsi, Mujahideen Khalq. That is the armed resistance, forces of the NCRI, the political umbrella group that I said before, headquartered just outside of Paris, Auvers-sur-Oise. But the MEK are the resistance forces inside the country, on the ground. In my opinion, and I don't know this, but this is my analysis, my own, I think they've probably been working with the Mossad for many years, because many of the revelations about Iran's nuclear weapons and ballistic missile programs have come out and been announced by the NCRI. But in any case, they've been the ones on the ground inside the country fighting, dying, going to jail, tortured, murdered for 47 years. And, Reza just doesn't have that connection or that background. So I would like to see, many would like to see all these opposition groups somehow come together, join forces. But I don't think that the Iranian people really want to go back to a monarchy. And given what has been reported, at least, about Reza's affiliations with the IRGC over these years, reports, that's probably the worst possible outcome that could possibly be for the Iranian people would be for an IRGC to remain in power with Reza as their puppet monarch.
Right.
That would just be the worst possible outcome, and everybody hopes that doesn't happen.
Well, the MEK has been, I don't know.
Vilified?
I guess we'll say, I was thinking slandered, but yeah, vilified over time. And the guys that we know are like, no, the MEK, they're the resistance fighters. They're not all those things they say about them.
Cool.
And they feel that, and I'm sure rightly so, that they were vilified just to, kneecap them.
Well, absolutely. I mean, they have been the most credible opposition force against this regime, if we leave aside maybe some of the ethnic groups, but otherwise, most credible, largest, best organized, oldest of all the resistance forces inside of Iran. And in addition, the political leadership, again, that being the NCRI, National Council of Resistance of Iran, and their leader, Madame Rajavi, Mariam Rajavi, have published, as long ago as 2006, a 10-point plan, which lays out the principles, the policies under which an NCRI-led transition government would administer Iran. And they include things, like I said before, of universal suffrage, free and fair democratic elections leading to a democrat-style republic of Iran, not the current Republic of Iran, but a democratic one. Among the 10-point plan include gender equality, autonomy for the minority groups, independent judiciary, freedom of speech, press, assembly, and so forth. Freedom of religion, no state religion, complete separation of religion and state. All of these things are in the 10-point plan, which can be found at Mariam Rajavi's own website, Mariam Rajavi, or you can go to the NCRI's website. Same 10-point plan will be found there, too. But this is their idea for the future of Iran. Now, Reza Pahlavi shares many of these same objectives and policies. The only thing is that he doesn't have the representation on the ground.
Yeah, because we didn't really hear much from him until all this started, and he popped up and wants to be the leader, and I thought, I don't know how that's going to work.
Yeah. Well, and I'm concerned as well by his open. And I'll tell you, when I say open, I mean I've been sitting in the audience at a think tank in Washington, D.C., to hear him say he wants to work with the Pazdaran, with the IRGC. And he's repeated that many times. That gives me a lot of pause.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I don't see that really happening successfully.
No.
Because they're not, these aren't people who are going to, it almost reminds me of, where
allow
they want.
Debate.
Well, when they want, like, coal miners to learn computer coding.
Yeah.
We're just going to transition them as computer coders. So maybe the IRGC, they're going to be social workers now.
The other thing about the IRGC is that even to be a member of the IRGC, which is the guardian of the revolution, it's not the guardian of the state, the nation state of Iran, or of its borders. Look at the constitution of Iran for that. It is, the IRGC is instead the guardian of the revolution, and its members are selected and they are vetted for ideological purity as a 12er Shiite Muslim. That is not the same thing as to say the Artesh. That is the word for the regular army. These are the conscripts, the regular army every day, that are not ideologically vetted for purity, as are, the IRGC. I can see the Artesh, because those are just, the regular local young men who get, conscripted into the armed forces. That's who they are, the regular armed forces of the country. But the Pazdaran, the IRGC, no, those are the guardians of the revolution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, plus, I think when you've had so much oppression in the last 40 years by these people, I don't know how you can put them back in any position of power and
have the
people enforce or, be in favor of that.
No, cannot be. Cannot happen.
No.
So what's your prediction? Does this last a long time, a short time? Do they fold? Do they just fight to the end of the end of the end? What do you think?
I think they will fight to the end, but for them that could come in just a few weeks. As President Trump, and we've heard also Secretary of War Pete Hegseth say this, Marco Rubio too, and Chief of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Dan Kane also, that it is expected that the Operation Epic Fury, together with, in close collaboration with the Israeli Operation Roaring Lion, will go on for another couple, 3 weeks, into April, let's say. But what is happening is that not only is the entire top leadership being removed, there is no more top leadership anymore, but their finances are being cut off. And that's what's happening with Karg Island. We didn't even talk about that, but that's the hub of Iran's oil export income. And not only did the United States wipe out the military forces, or defenses, I should say, the air defenses of Karg Island a bit ago, but are now moving a couple of MEUs, Marine Expeditionary Units, one the USS Tripoli and another one en route to the Persian Gulf, if need be, to take physical control of Karg Island, not to destroy its storage tanks or its piping system, its infrastructure for the oil, rather to leave that for the next government of the Iranian people, which, by the way, the Iranian people will decide for themselves what that leadership will be. But to take control of Karg Island away from whatever's left of this regime so that its financial collapse will come even sooner. And as well, now that some of our European partners are stepping up, it looks like the Strait of Hormuz likewise is going to be opened pretty soon.
Nice. Well, just so people can go reference some of this, I put links for you to the things that we were talking about. That, you know, you hear a bunch of acronyms, and it's like, wait. So the National Council of Resistance of Iran, I put a link on there for you. And I had Miriam Rajavi's 10-point plan from a previous show, so I linked that on there so people can read it. She's terrific.
I think so, too. I've met her and spoken with her previously. She is a tiny, petite lady, but a spine of steel.
And she can obviously, she's obviously got incredible security because she's still alive and she's been at a while. Claire, we have to do this again soon. I hope scheduling will allow for you to pop on with us.
We'd be happy to.
Thank you.
Just let me know.
Our guest has been Claire Lopez. You're listening to We the People. We'll be right back and talk about some fuel and stuff. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. Good afternoon, and welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. This is hour two on Sunday, March 22nd, 2026. And we just finished a segment with Claire Lopez on the whole Iran thing. Obviously, we ran out of time because with Claire, you always run out of time, but I do hope you will go back and listen to the archive. You can find it either here on KCNR's website at kcnrradio.com. You can go to wethepeopleradio.us and we pull out all the free enterprise moments and so that you have uninterrupted listening. How about that? And you're free to send it to anybody. You're free to utilize anything we have. We don't copyright anything. We want to make it available to the public so that it is useful data for you. Did I let you say who you are?
No.
Or did I just cut you off?
Oh, yeah. No.
Okay, okay.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Aaron Ryan.
Hi, Aaron.
Your turn.
Hi. And I'm Bill Cundiff.
Yep. 15 years we've been doing this. But every week it's like a brand new show. Oh, my gosh. I'll be hiding my own Easter eggs if I'm not careful. Our guest this hour, we're going to kind of switch gears a little bit, but not quite so much. Our guest is Ronald Stein. He is a professional engineer. I had to do a little homework on that. I thought, professional engineer, what does that mean exactly? And I really thought it was pretty neat. Holding the PE, the professional engineer designation, comes with a serious responsibility. Professional engineers must adhere to a strict code of ethics that governs their conduct and decisions, and those standards emphasize public safety, honesty, and integrity. Violations can lead to a loss of licensure and legal consequences. I thought, wow. So, no funny business here. We're going to get just the facts. So, he's an energy consultant on energy literacy. God knows we need tons of that. California is awash in energy imbeciles. He is an ambassador for energy and infrastructure. Need that too. Co-author of the Pulitzer Prize-nominated book, Clean Energy Exploitations, and a policy advisor on energy literacy for the Heartland Institute. We love them. And the Committee for Constructive Tomorrow, and a national TV commentator. He just is busy, and I have posted his books, actually, Energy Made Easy. I thought that was fun, and Just Green Electricity. I thought was also kind of caught my eye. And before I forget here, America Out Loud News is where much of his stuff is posted, and we have that on our page. But it's americaoutloud.news.
You know, it's not that easy being green.
you can look that up for us and play it at the break.
Well, also, I don't think you can limit energy imbeciles in California. I think there's
that's true. That's true.
Many
we're drowning in them.
Yes.
But the thing that is as far as things that are going on now, right now, he has also authored a couple of articles. People who listen to the show frequently and are following that domain at gascrisis.org that tracks to our show, you will find that he has done some articles with Professor Michael Miché. Be like, oh, we know that guy. We've talked to him before. So, Clean Energy Exploitation, you should probably get that book and the others. But AmericaOutloud.news is quite a site. I thought it was just his. And I started reading. I sent him a thing. I told him I need an SOS. Somebody's going to come rescue me. There is so much information there. So, okay, do you go by Ronald or Ron?
Yes, either one.
Oh, darn it.
No answer to both.
Well, Bill is a William Call Me Bill, so I always, always like to ask, but I noticed your emails were signed with Ron, so I was like, should we go there? So I don't even know where you would like to start today, but we are a target-rich environment in this state, are we not?
Yes, we are, and the policies we have in California of reducing emissions is really making California a national security risk for the entire country,
mm-hmm.
because we're the fourth largest economy in the world, and we have three of the largest shipping ports, L.A., Long Beach, and Oakland. We have 30 major military installations. We've got 9 international airports, and just the airports and the military installations, they're consuming, 13 million gallons of aviation fuel every day. And the interesting thing about California, we're an energy island. We're separated from the other 49 states by the Sierra Mountains. There's no pipelines over the mountains. So if there's a refinery in Texas, there's no way to get fuel to California other than through the Panama Canal. And it's cheaper to bring it in from China. And so, we're an energy island, and that's the differentiation that separates us from other states that are going green. And because all the fuel we use here is basically made here. You have to understand that crude oil by itself is useless. It's like the Beverly Hillbillies. It's bubbling out of the ground. It's useless black tar. But if you build a multi-billion-dollar refinery, and they heat it, they beat it, and they crack it, they do all these crazy things to it, and they extract from the crude oil transportation fuels, jet fuel, gasoline, bunker fuel for the ships, diesel fuel for the trucks, and all the minerals and metals that make all the products in our daily lives, oil is useless. And that's the thing that the world's starting to recognize, that refineries, it's really not oil driving the economy, it's the refineries.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you get the products that you use, then you go. Because you see it right now in Ukraine is attacking Russian refineries. If you can take out the Russian refineries, you could demobilize the military. And, that's an interesting thing that in California, the regulations are already limited to refineries, and there's 7 left. Four of them are really big. Two from Chevron and 2 from PBF. And right now we have refinery capacity that cannot make the fuel needed in California. So we'll be importing fuel. And that's a scary thing. We have 30 military installations being run by foreign refineries. That is scary.
Yeah.
Well, that's just stupid.
Well, what's insane is instead of importing all this stuff, we should be exporting. We have enough to export as much as we want if we were allowed to drill and build our infrastructure, we could export. We could probably be the largest exporter. But
you're right. Yeah, we have a lot of natural resources here, but oil production is on the decline, terminal decline. You know, permitting and setbacks and everything else, and everything that Trump wants to do to produce oil, Newsom is Trump-proofing California.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, he's basically stopping everything. So we're setting the tone. And like I say, the fourth largest economy in the world is going to be run by foreign refineries.
That's yeah, if they want.
Yeah, you know. Until they decide that they don't.
Yeah, they want to put a little hurt on us. All they have to do is stop mm-hmm. the flow, and we would be in terrible shape.
Well, and like we've been told before, you know, one refinery fire, you know, slows everything down. If you had a ship that goes down in the ocean or
big storm,
problem at the ports.
Yeah, a lot can go wrong with that scenario.
So Ron, we have said, go ahead.
Well, the paradox of California's environmental policies is we're going to be increasing worldwide emissions.
Right.
Because these foreign countries don't have the same controls we do. And then you've got to bring that transportation fuel by a ship thousands of miles over the ocean. So, yeah, California emission controls is actually going to be increasing worldwide emissions.
Mm-hmm.
That's the paradox.
Do you think, I know that this last week the news was all a flutter with, oh, we're going to be drilling offshore in California and the Defense Production Act and all that. And I don't know what the percentage is, but I'd say 80 to 85% of the people in this state kind of breathed a sigh of relief and thought, oh, okay, we're going to be good now. I don't think they realize we don't have the ability and may not have the ability to refine it. Especially if these guys leave.
Well, you're right. I mean, because when you take a look at crude oil, we had, before those two refineries shut down, back in 95, I think we were pretty much 95% self-sufficient. Between California oil production and Alaska oil production, it met 95% of the demands of California. Well, we've been clamping down on oil production here, so in 95, we were 5% depending on foreign imported oil, and that increased to over 60%. Well, the good news, bad news. The good news is we'll be importing less crude oil because we have less refineries to refine it. The bad news is instead of crude oil coming in, we'll be importing the finished product.
Mm-hmm.
If we changed this California blend and all that, what kind of a difference would that make in the scope of all things? I mean, we've been told it does very little for the environment in comparison to what's available elsewhere.
I'd probably leave it up to the refineries to answer that question. It's, you know, the other thing, too, is, you know, I'm not sure. We have a special California blend. I'm not sure China refineries are going to be excited about producing a California blend. So
right?
We don't have as much control over them. It's kind of like, you know, whatever they make, we're going to take. You know?
Well, that question came up with the last time we had them on the air was this fuel we're going to import from India and South Korea. Is anybody checking to see if that fuel stands up to the California requirements? And then nobody seemed to know the answer to that.
Nope, ask Gus Newsom. That's what he wants.
Yeah.
So, you know, like I said, we're losing control to control what they're doing. You know? So, yeah, we'll be at the mercy of whatever they make. We'll have to take.
Exactly. I read, too, you were bringing up the point of oil or wind and solar doesn't produce anything, where oil produces a lot.
That's true. That's true. They keep talking about the energy transition.
Right.
It's not an energy transition. It's an electricity transition.
Right.
Because wind and solar, all they do is produce electricity. They don't make anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, take a look in your house, the hospitals, the airports, and try and identify one thing this one thing that a wind turbine made? It don't make anything.
Mm-mm.
It just makes electricity. Now, the real crux, electricity came after oil. Let me repeat that. Electricity came after oil. We got six ways to generate electricity. You can do it by wind, solar, natural gas, coal, hydro, nuclear. But all six ways to generate electricity came after. Et cetera, et cetera. So if you get rid of oil, you get rid of electricity. Back to the 1800s.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the other thing is all the green solutions, wind turbines, solar panels, EVs, they're all 100% made with oil.
isn't that awkward?
The lubrication. I mean, take the EV. You know, the tires, the wires, the insulation. It's 100% made with oil. And, you know, if you go to EVs, and you know, some ones, everybody driving an EV. Well, if you drive an EV, he's going to eliminate one product made at the refinery. It's gasoline. But what about the other 5,999 products that are part of our daily lives, you know?
Well,
you know, everything, the other thing to look at, too, is everything that needs electricity, let me repeat that, everything that needs electricity, iPhones, computers, air conditioning, et cetera, again, is made with the products made from oil. So if you get rid of oil, you get rid of everything.
Yeah, and there's not a lot of alternatives. I mean, they, you know, you have soybean oil and things like that, but not at the volume you'd need to keep up with the production of what we make today with oil.
You're right. Yeah, it's scale. You know, there are alternatives, but there's nothing that can scale to meet what the world needs. And so, yeah, we're in a field of hurt here. And I don't know, like I say, my passion with all the articles I've written, my weekly articles that go out, and I co-author with people around the world from South Africa, Japan, you know, whatever. And my passion is to stimulate conversations. And I tell people, I'm 100% in favor of getting rid of oil. What's your backup plan? And we've had 200 years to replace it, and been unable to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And as I mentioned, like say the replacements, the pouring rain, are oil based. You know, the turbine blades, the solar panels, all the lubrication, you know, goes into EVs, and it's just amazing that no one's relating these two. So that's why I really push the fact that it's the energy transition is not energy transition; it's electricity transition. And that's the reason electricity is going up, because you wind up having a redundant system. You've got the reliable power, which is coal or natural gas or hydro or nuclear, which is continuous. And then you have a redundant system of wind and solar, which is weather dependent. And if Newsom wants to run the world on wind and solar, it scares me to think that the surgeon, before he goes to surgery, is going to have to check the weather report.
Well, yeah, because it does. You're looking at intermittent, you know, power supply. You can't run a business on an intermittent power supply.
Right, right. I mean, like I always say, when I'm on Zoom, I always give an example. I hold up my iPhone. Electricity can charge my iPhone, but electricity cannot make my iPhone.
Now, that's a really good example.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true of basically everything. A computer, anything. Electricity, you know, allows it to operate, but electricity cannot make it.
Yeah, that's one of your notes on here. So for people who are like, ooh, I want to use that, it's actually on the page. Your thing said, it's shocking that policymakers are oblivious to the reality that wind turbines and solar panels do different things than crude oil. And your first point, renewables, such as wind turbines and solar panels, only exist to generate occasional electricity under favorable weather conditions, since they cannot make tires, toilet paper, iPhones, or any product or transportation fuels to support lifestyles and economies around the world. I mean, we can't switch over. That doesn't mean it's not even possible.
No. And, you know, the scary thing is, of the 8 billion people living on this planet, 80% of them, that's more than 6 billion people, they're living in poverty. They haven't joined the Industrial Revolution. And they may never, if they don't have the products that are made from oil. You know, it's kind of like a restaurant. If a restaurant's serving bad food, stop going to it, the restaurant goes out of business. Well, if you're eating a steak and, you know, at the same time you're raising your flag, we've got to stop killing cattle. You know, duh. You just stop eating the steak. You know, stop that too. But the key thing is, if you really want to get rid of oil, stop using the products.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
You know, is Newsom to come out and say, we're going to close the airports, we're going to close the shopping centers, you know. And, no, that's not going to happen.
Well, even there are little electric bikes, you know, or even just the ones where you pedal power, you need oil.
Exactly. Yeah.
So,
you know, like I said, I keep telling people, identify something, just one thing that was made by a wind turbine or a solar panel.
I'm going to start doing that.
I've seen several giant messes created by a wind turbine.
Yeah, really? And some dead birds. We got a pile of dead birds. Do we have any songs about dead birds? We have to take a really quick break. We did find Kermit the Frog, though. We thought he would be fun to bring in about being green. But our guest is Ron Stein. You're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
It's not easy being green, having to spend each day the color of the leaves. When I think it might be nicer being red or yellow or gold or something much more colorful like that.
Yeah, even Bachman Turner Overdrive knew. They were on vinyl. We wouldn't even know that song if we didn't have vinyl. So Ron, when you speak you guys do conventions, I mean, you're very prolific in the education on all of this. Do you get the impression that there's any moving of the needle, I guess?
I think, yes. I've been doing this for like 10 years, focusing on this, writing articles weekly and the books I've written. And the good news is I'm seeing articles written around the world addressing the same subject. In fact, a lot of times when I do an article, I co-author with somebody else because, you know, it's an opinion, but I want to make sure it's just not my opinion. It might be somebody from Japan, South Africa, and it's a worldwide problem. And I think there's more and more people following the message and trying to stimulate conversations to get this down to reality, because the people that have the power and have the microphone, they're the ones setting the budget and setting the policies, but the policies are not for all the people. And that's really scary, because any transition really has to be for the 8 billion people on this planet. You know, we've come up with this transition from going to wind and solar. But wind and solar is very expensive. It's costing trillions of dollars. And who can afford that? The wealthy countries. And it's amazing how much money and effort we've been put into wind and solar by the United States, by the UK, et cetera, et cetera. And you know, we're just getting electricity, and it's a redundant electricity supply system that's built into the rate you're paying for electricity. Think Germany. I mean, they're the first ones to get rid of all their coal-fired power plants, mm-hmm. get rid of all their, you know, nuclear. They got the most expensive electricity in the world. And we're following them. We're right behind them.
Well, it's really not a transition. It's
substitution.
Yeah, they're substituting. They're not transitioning it because you still have a massive amount of the economy dependent on oil, and like you said, they're transitioning a portion, and I think a very small portion of electricity, but nothing else. So it's
right.
It's very lopsided, and it's also, I think, a technology that works, but it doesn't work on a mass scale. We're not ready for that. Our infrastructure's not set up for it. I think a big reason we're going through this whole gas crisis is because they're still hooked on the idea that everybody's going to transition to electric cars. Well, we can't do that. If a third of the population of California went to electric cars, it'd crash our grid. Plus, there's no place to charge them. We're just not set up for it. And that part of the equation has been completely overlooked. Even if they don't want to admit it, it's...
I think it's like it's just denied.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like they've... Do you get the impression that these things have been evaluated and they've come up with this answer, or if it's just like, hey, we don't like those choices, so we're just not going to talk about them?
There's no engineering talent in the policy-making effort.
Oh, Lord, yes, we neglected your specialty. Your people are not there, are they?
But, you know, in California, you know, the fact that Newsom wants everybody to drive an EV, well, the only thing that's going to reduce out of oil that people see is gasoline. I mean, you still need oil to make the cars. And the thing about EVs mm-hmm. is the elites have bought them. The elites will continue to buy them. But we're running out of elites.
Yeah.
Now we get down to the common folk. I mean, I live in an area in Southern California. Most of my neighbors have an EV as a second vehicle. It's never used. It's a backup car.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, most people can't afford a car to begin with, let alone two cars. And so it really puts a challenge on it.
Sure does. Yeah, the cost of the car is a major hurdle to start with. But you're right. You know, you go into areas, I mean, we travel down to Walnut Creek every once in a while, and you go down there, and you see quite a few more Teslas and electric vehicles down there. But as soon as you get out of the, you know, high income neighborhoods, you don't see them anymore.
Right.
And that's I think that's pretty telling.
And it's telling right now in the financial news too, because Ford they've written off I think $19 billion in removing several EV models from their lineup. GM, they're down billions on their EV assets.
Mm-hmm.
Honda, they wrote off, I think, $15 billion for their EVs. And, yeah, like I say, it's the common folks who are not buying EVs. And, another thing that people don't talk about is California's a big state.
Right.
You got 400,000 miles of roadway.
Sure.
And right now, the California fuel taxes raises almost $9 billion to maintain those 40,000 miles of roadway. So now we're putting EVs on the road. They're heavier. We're going to tear up the road more. And we're going to be losing all the revenue to repair the roads.
Mm-hmm.
There's no fuel taxes that will be collected.
Right.
So if everybody had an EV, there'd be no fuel taxes. And, you know, putting heavier vehicles on 400,000 miles of roadway and less money to maintain it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a no-brainer.
Oh yeah, but they'll just implement their
vehicle miles traveled tax.
Yeah, their mileage tax, so all the people that aren't driving electric cars can pay for the people that do. That should go over really well.
Yes, that would really help. Help the poverty level go up.
Exactly.
Well, can you imagine? Here you have all of the electric fans, right? And so what happens when they whip around and start charging them the vehicle miles travel tax? Because they will.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, nobody's getting out of this deal.
Yeah, they'll charge them, too, because they're still using the road. So yeah, now what's your advantage?
Yeah. On the national security front, where do you see that going? I mean, is this next down, I guess, in my, 30,000-foot view, I see the consumers having no fuel and all of it being routed to military and whatnot for national security.
Well, there's a couple things on national security because, yes, we'd have our military airports run by foreign, fuels, our international airports run by fuels coming from foreign countries, out of our control. But the thing that would really affect our economy is having three of the biggest, busiest ports in the country. All the products that come into Long Beach and Los Angeles and Oakland, they get unloaded, and what happens when they unload them? They put them on a truck to the rest of the country. Well, if those products, if you can't fuel the ships aren't going to come in. And if you don't have fuel for the trucks, you need products to put on the trucks, and you need fuel for the trucks. The rest of the country is going to suffer, too, because they're not going to be getting deliveries that they have been getting in the past. So it just snowballs.
And don't forget, our airports, our international airports, I mean, they've got to use an ungodly amount of jet fuel. Are we just going to shut them down because we don't have enough jet fuel? That would absolutely kneecap our economy.
Yes. Between the, there's, again, being a big state, there's 9 airports that take international flights between San Diego and, Northern California. And, the aviation fuel they're using and the aviation fuel the military's using, that's like 13 million gallons a day.
Yeah, it's we were back in New York a few years ago and we went up to the top of one of the buildings. I don't remember which one it was.
I believe it was the Empire State Building.
Empire State Building.
The big one.
Looked down at the traffic and it just looked like a sea of taxi cabs. I mean, it was 3/4 of the cars on the road were yellow, it's like people there use public transportation and taxis. Not everybody has a car. But in California, you have to have a car. You don't have mass transit in every town. You have to have a vehicle to get around. And I think that alone should kind of frighten people that if we go into a gas shortage, you're going to have millions of people unable to move around.
Exactly. That's interesting. The price of the pump for your fuel has all these taxes, all these environmental programs. And every time I fuel up, and I did that this morning, part of the cost I'm paying at the pump, I'm paying for the high-speed rail.
Yeah.
I'm still holding my breath for that one.
Yeah. With not one inch of track?
That's right.
Well, your article that, one of the articles anyway, that you and Michael Miché did back in, this was in July of 2025. I mean, it was a while ago, titled California Continues to Devastate Its Economy for a Net Zero Dream World. Since I would have to go back and do a little homework, but I don't know how many refineries that we have lost since that time, but Valero was just the most recent, but...
Yeah, it was Phillips and Valero. We lost those two refineries. And I think that was represented about, 17% of the fuel being consumed here. So it's going to be made up by foreign refineries.
Yeah.
So we don't have that many refineries left. We have like 7 left.
Yeah, we have 7.
7 left are big, the big ones.
And 6...
The thing that scares me is, Chevron... They moved their corporate headquarters to Texas.
Right.
And they got 2 of the largest refineries in California. And I was wondering, Are they going next?
Well, they've issued the letter, you know, so for anybody who thinks we might be, you know, scaring everyone for nothing or whatever, please go to gascrisis.org. That takes you directly to the page on our site that has the letters from the three companies, Chevron, PBF, and Marathon. Those letters from those corporations are there, and they're very clear. It's like, Dear California Air Resources Board, if you continue to screw us over, we're going to go away.
Yeah, we're shutting down.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's the gist of it.
Right,
I think it was the Chevron letter actually said, and, you know, didn't say this, but this is what I heard, was, hey, just in case you forgot what we do, and then it listed, like, what they provide, you know, 50% of the marine fuel to the ports and different things like that. I thought, yeah, and these guys aren't moving. The CARB isn't moving on that.
And so far, they've been able to, I think, keep ahead of the game by raising prices and, you know, their various distribution means. But the time is coming when price isn't going to be the issue. It's going to be availability. And you're going to pull into a gas station and they may not have gas, or you may be limited to 10 gallons or who knows. But the availability is the biggie. It's just not going to be available for you. So,
right, it's supply and demand. And,
yeah.
And CARB, what they're doing, the reason they wrote that letter to CARB is CARB is tightening up on the emission standards. And these refineries are the cleanest in the world in California. And, you know, I can't fault them for leaving. It's a business decision. They're basically manufactured.
Of course.
They're taking crude oil, and they're making products that are usable by the public. And they can make it here, or they could make it in Texas or Oklahoma or somewhere else where they have access to some crude oil. And, yeah, so it's an easy decision for some of them.
Well, and I've had people say, oh, well, the president will just stop them. It's like, hot tip, we talk about communism, but we haven't actually adopted it yet.
No.
You know, Zoran Mondami isn't running the country, and we didn't sign up for that yet. You cannot hold companies here, and I do find it fascinating that Steyer, Tom Steyer, who's running for governor, God save us all, is campaigning that he stopped big oil. And I thought, well, everybody goes to the pump, ought to thank Tom Steyer for that.
Yeah.
We have to take a really quick break. We're going to be back with our guest, Ron Stein. He is the co-author of the Pulitzer Prize-nominated book, Clean Energy Exploitations. And God knows we're living that dream. We'll be right back. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Riding along in my automobile, my baby beside me at the wheel. I stole a kiss at the turn of a mile, my curiosity running wild. Cruising and playing the radio with no particular place to go. Riding along in my automobile.
What was gas? 3 cents. Song kind of gives me a little seizure every time I think about it. So, if two, what's your, I guess it all depends on which two, right? But if one of those companies left and took their two refineries down to the studs, can we survive?
It would be an economic disaster for Californians. We'd be paying a real premium, and like I said, the businesses, I think in the last decade, there's 800 companies that left California, some of them even major companies.
Yeah, I just don't think the supply will be there.
Yeah. Because everything's so expensive, cost of fuel drives everything.
Drives everything,
the fuel goes up, cost of tomatoes goes up, the cost of labor goes up, and it's just really expensive to run a business here. And if you're, with all the internet access, you can basically run that business on the other side of the border of California. In Arizona, Texas, Wisconsin, you pick it. I mean, everything is cheaper. You take a look at our gas prices and their gas prices. That's pretty much indicative of the labor cost, too. And it just drives everything. So it would be devastating. I think they really have to identify, before they, I would say allow them to shut it down, because they shut down, they're going to shut down, but you really got to find out which country are we going to be dependent on to replace them. We haven't built a refinery in the United States in about 50 years. Now, they're building a new one in Brownsville, Texas. But as I mentioned to a lot of the people down in Texas, that's of no use to us.
Right.
All the fuel they make, there's no way to get that to California. You can't bring it by truck, not the volume we need. And, you can't send it through the Panama Canal. It's cheaper to bring it in from the Bahamas. So it can be an economic disaster, especially with us being the fourth largest economy in the world. You are pretty much shut down the fourth largest economy in the world. And that would be devastating to every business and everybody living here.
Yeah, I don't... Do you deal with the policymaker side, or are you predominantly in the education side?
On the education side. I always joke that I would love to have a conversation with these policymakers. In fact, some of the articles I've written is really intended to be like a bunch of questions for ABC, NBC, CBS, CNN, because this is an election year. A lot of people running for mayor, a lot of people running for governor, and ultimately somebody to be running for president. And these are the questions that have to be asked of the candidates. I mean, like Tom Steyer, he wants to get rid of oil. Well, I've got a bunch of questions. What's your backup plan? How do you keep airports running? How do you keep the hospitals running? And I just need to know. I don't want to put them on the spot. I really do.
No, you do. We owe it to the rest of the people who don't know to ask the question.
I think these candidates have to share their energy literacy with the public. They understand the implications of what they're doing.
Yeah, because until we really demand that, we're not going to get any change. Any ideas on strategy? Let's say, I know we've talked to some of the refinery guys and folks in this industry, and they say once you shutter a refinery, you don't just bring it back up.
No, it takes decades to get these things planned and built, and they've got to get their contracts set, because you don't want to build a refinery without a supply of crude oil. So you've got to have the supply lined up. Guarantee you've got something to manufacture from. So they're very complicated and very time consuming. And really financial commitments.
Sure.
Commitments.
And even if we overrode, if the federal government overrode the idiotic California rules that are crushing them, that they pay all of these CARB regulatory fees and stuff, and then the guys producing overseas don't pay any of it, kind of a little bit of an inequity there from a business standpoint, and they've noticed. Huh, imagine that. So if the federal government said, hey, look, you guys are obviously, too stupid to take care of yourselves, and so we're going to step in and help you so you don't kill your state and the people in it. I don't. If I was a company, I don't think I would stay, because as soon as this administration is gone, it seems like the boot goes right back on your neck again.
Exactly. Yeah, the cost of labor is really tough, and the cost of labor is really driven by more oil. If you make all the products very expensive, then just cost of living goes up, and if cost of living goes up, you demand higher wage rates. And yeah, the minimum wage in California is much higher than the minimum wage in Mississippi.
Oh, sure.
Well, that's true, too.
And like, so that's the reason why a lot of companies that are, you know, leaving, they're just leaving to less expensive places to operate. It's a business decision, return on investment, because a business is looking to make a widget and sell their widget. And if they can make their widget for less money, and they might be able to have a more effective product to sell.
If you were, you know, making changes and had the ability to, you know, kind of move the chess pieces around, do you see any way to kind of cut through the middle, you know, make the green energy people happy while we can still operate in a modern society without, you know, going right straight to Thunderdome?
Well, I joke with people, you can't bring a logical question into this conversation.
I was trying not to be difficult, but yeah, that's kind of, I guess that's the thing. How do you?
Exactly, because, you know, these are logical questions, but, you know, you bring it up and you just hit a brick wall. The green has, you know, so much momentum and a lot of funding that, you know, it's ongoing. You know, take the EVs. You know, there's a lot of lithium in California, I think. But we have environmental laws. We've got labor laws. I mean, if you want to mine for lithium here in California, that would raise the cost of lithium, which would raise the cost of the battery.
We are literally just winding ourselves into the dark ages, aren't we?
Exactly. And the book I wrote, Clean Energy Exploitations, is all the exotic minerals and metals to build that battery, the lithium and the cobalt, is controlled by China and Africa. And they're mining for these minerals and metals with child labor. They got no labor laws. And the environmental degradation is atrocious because they have minimum environmental laws. So we're exploiting people who have yellow, brown, and black skin, so we can get that EV battery, and the environmental degradation is atrocious. And the photograph we had on the book was a photograph from Africa. It was a military guy with an Uzi overlooking a family mining for lithium by hand.
I got to look at that again.
Yeah, people don't seem to, doesn't seem to bother people. If they don't see it, it's not happening. They just want
their... people ask me, they ask me if I have an EV. I said, no. They say, would you buy an EV? I said, no. And they say, why? I said, for ethical and moral reasons. They said, what the hell do you mean by that? And I explained, I'm not willing to financially support guy in Africa for them to exploit their people and to do environmental degradation on their land so I can feel good about, you know, going green. Now, ironically, our government does. They're basically providing financial incentives for China and Africa to continue exploiting their people with different colored skins and continue the environmental degradation because California is going green with EVs. So I think that's unethical and immoral, but that's another issue.
No, it's a really good point. We've done a huge amount of shows on China and the, you know, the conditions there. One of our guests routinely refers to it as the agreement that we have with them is a type of generous barbarism.
Yes. Yes, it's it is a, you know, double standard. And I keep thinking, you know, in my office I've got the globe that circulates around. And, you know, California represents, I think, half of 1% the world's population.
Mm-hmm.
The other 99.5% of the world lives outside of California. And we're the fourth largest economy trying to set all these environmental policies and goals, and it's going to be devastating. This state But I think it's going to prevent the 6 billion in poverty from ever joining the Industrial Revolution.
That's a really good point. Because we're forcing them to do something that isn't working for us. And the piece of the puzzle we haven't even touched here with just a couple of minutes left is our food supply. You can't...
That's right.
You know, there are no farms running electric, you know, harvesters and electric... I mean, just even electric mowers. John Deere got caught in the crossfire of that here in California and couldn't sell electric mowers. Well, that's nice if you have a small front yard, but if you're mowing anything of substance...
Technology's not there.
That's the challenge. It's the scale.
Yeah.
There's so many people, and,
And if you don't...
There are solutions that work, but they're small.
Yeah, and if you don't have to switch to electric, and you're a business, and your gas power equipment is more efficient... is more economical to operate. It makes no sense to switch over to electric. And I mean, yeah, people want to do the right thing and have a green economy and blah blah blah. But I'm not sure they've even proven that technology is any more green than what we have now. When you look at how they're produced, where they're produced, the amount of pollution that comes from, you know, producing them overseas. We're just moving the smog cloud around the globe, you know. So.
Well, that's right, because the emissions, like I say, they're much more, much greater than California.
Sure.
And so we're shutting down green refineries, and you're going to basically replace them with refineries in another country that's not as clean. I think we breathe the same air.
Mm-hmm.
What? You mean the air over California isn't special?
Well, I think Newsom thinks it is. He only breathes California air.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Well, it's interesting because as we head into an election, I always figure the worst thing that we could do in the state of California would be to allow people to believe that the issues in Iran are driving our fuel prices up. That would just be missing the boat completely because all of this is really self-imposed.
Exactly.
Our time has run out. Our guest, Ron Stein, we're going to have you come back and talk to us some more about energy literacy because God knows there is a dearth of energy literacy sweeping the globe.
Very good.
His book is Clean Energy Exploitations. You should definitely read it. We've linked it up for you at WeThePeopleRadio.us.
You know there ain't no rest for the wicked. Money don't grow on trees. We got bills to pay, we got mouths to feed. There ain't nothing in this world for free. I know we can't slow down, we can't hold back, though you know we wish we could. I know there ain't no rest for the wicked until we close our eyes for good.